a man was on a diet and he was struggling, and he had to go into town on some business. And as he started out, he remembered that his route would take him past a lovely cake shop and tea room. And as he got closer, he thought, well, you know, a cup of tea, a nice piece of cake, would just hit the spot. And then he remembered his diet. And that's when he prayed, Lord, if you want me to stop for a cup of tea and a lovely slice of chocolate cake, let there be a parking spot right outside the tea room. And you know, sure enough, on the seventh time round the block, he found a parking space right outside the tea room. You see, most of us want to be delivered from temptation, but we just like to keep in touch with it now and again. Or as Oscar Wilde once said, I can resist anything but temptation. Well, as you know, we're working our way through the book of James, and in our study, we've reached a passage that deals with the issues of trials, temptation, and sin. Let's have a look at it. James 1, beginning in verse 13. James 1 and verse 13. James writes, when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desire and enticed. And then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. Don't be deceived, my dear brothers and sisters. Now, as I've mentioned before, the book of James corresponds to what we would call in the Old Testament wisdom literature. And there's a very close parallel to what is written here in Proverbs chapter 7. Proverbs chapter 7. Because here is a graphic story of a man who is lacking sense. And he succumbs to the loose woman's enticement. Proverbs 7 and verse 7, the writer says, I saw among the sinful, I noticed among the young men, a youth who had no sense. And his first mistake was that he passed near the corner where she lived. I wonder if he circulated it seven times. But he passed near the corner. And in verse 8, it says, he was going down the street near her corner, walking along in the direction of her house. And, you know, as luck would have it, at that very moment she happens to come out of her door. Verse 10. Then out came the woman to meet him, dressed like a prostitute with crafty intent. And you know what? As further luck would have it, her husband had gone on a long trip. Verse 19. My husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. And then in verse 21, with persuasive words she led him astray. She seduced him with her smooth talk. All at once he followed her like an ox going to the slaughter, like a deer stepping into a noose till an arrow pierces his liver, like a bird darting into a snare, little knowing that it will cost him his life. And then the story concludes in verse 26. Many are the victims she has brought down. Her slain are a mighty throng. Her house is a highway to the grave, leading down to the chambers of death. And James is warning his readers, don't be deceived. Going ahead and succumbing to temptation now has consequences that go on that we cannot control. And it's interesting that James uses the picture of birth and growth here. There's a development to whatever we do. There are ongoing effects. We don't just live a life of isolated incidents. Our actions do have consequences. And the direction that our temptation will take us is eventually death. Now that's something to ponder, isn't it? So easy to take lightly our little sins. We fail to see often where they will lead us. So in his letter, James is continuing to give us wisdom towards the crown of life that he mentioned in verse 12, and not to be deceived as to where succumbing to our temptations can lead us, which, he says, verse 15, is death. This wisdom then provides us with a strategy for overcoming the deadly lure of temptation. And he begins by showing us the source of temptation. Where doesn't it come from, and where does it come from? Let's go back to James chapter 1. James has been writing about trials from verse 2, and then suddenly says in verse 13, when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. And it seems like he's changing the subject. Now we're going to move on from talking about trials, and we're going to start to talk about temptations, but actually that's not the case. It's not easy to spot in English, but the Greek word that James uses and is rendered tempted in verse 13 is the same word that is used in verses 2 and 12 that the translators rendered trial. The Greek word in question is perasmos, and it's a word that can have a number of different nuances. But the nuance in verses 13 to 15 has to do with this inner enticement towards sin. The teaching that James is getting across to us here is that God tests us, but he never tempts us. God tests or tries the believer's faith, but he doesn't tempt anyone to sin. See, for example, God tested Abraham by asking him to sacrifice his son Isaac in Genesis 22. God tested the Israelites regarding the gathering of manna in Exodus 16. God tested Job by allowing Satan to afflict him with all of the trials that we see in Job chapters 1 and 2. And this testing is for a reason. We've just sung about it, actually. Notice Psalm 66 and verse 10. For you, God, tested us. You refined us like silver. And then in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verses 6 to 7, Peter says, in all of this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief of all kinds of trials. These have come so that the proven genuineness of your faith, of greater worth than gold which perishes, even though refined by fire, may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. So with his people, the purpose of God's testing is to refine our faith like gold or silver. And he does this in order that we can become mature and complete, not lacking anything, as James has already said in this chapter. But with every test comes temptation. And James has just written about the poor and the rich in verses 9 and 11. And if you look again at those verses, you'll see that any change in your existence is a test. If you fall into poverty, that's a test. If you fall into riches and success, that's a test. Every adversity and every prosperity, every difficulty and every success is a test that could either make you wiser, it's an opportunity for greater growth. And if you handle it properly, you'll move towards the crown of life. But you see, that same opportunity is also a terrible danger. Because if you mishandle it, it moves you from test to temptation to sin, and as James says, into death. Every change in your situation, whether it's a good change or a bad change, is something that will push you to become a much better person or a much worse person than you were before. But one thing is true, you will never stay the same. If you make a lot of money, or you lose a lot of money, both of those things are tests. And when they come into your life, you'll be pushed to the crown of life, or you'll be pushed down to death, one or the other. Now just think about that. What happens if you strike it rich? What happens if you start to get wealthy? Well, you can either let it humble you, and you can say, Lord, why me? I know there are lots of bright people out there. There's lots of talented, hard-working people who haven't made it. And yet I've been successful. It's a real blessing from you, Lord. You see, you can let it humble you. But not only that, you can actually allow it to make you a more generous person as a result. You know, as a person who's doing financially well, you can start to reason something like this. You know, I can now give more in support of the gospel. I can give more to those people who are not so well off. Of course, I won't be able to live as high a life as I might have been able to, but I can still live very comfortably. You see, you can allow it to make you a humbler person, and you can allow it to make you a more generous person. Or, what will happen is, it will make you more arrogant. You'll begin to say, the reason that I'm successful is because I'm a higher class of person. I'm a little bit smarter than everybody else. I'm a little bit better. I'm a little more savvier. I've worked harder than other people. That's the reason why I'm doing so well. And you know, it can also make you less generous. You know, statistics have shown that people who make under £25,000 a year give away around 4% of their income to charity on average. While people who make over £100,000 a year give less than 1% of their income. Now why is that? Because riches can also tempt you into believing that luxuries are necessities. You see, wealth won't keep you the same. If you're financially successful, it will make you far more humble, far more generous, a far more useful Christian than you were before, or it will make you harder, less generous, more arrogant, but it will not keep you the same. Now that's true in every situation. The same thing happens with adversity. If things go badly in your life, you can either let it make you more humble, you can let it make you a more compassionate person, more understanding to other people who are going through similar experiences that you are going through, or it can make you bitter. It can make you anxious. It can make you despondent. But it will not leave you where you are. With trials and tests come temptations. And because trials come with temptations, it's so important for us to recognize that temptation never comes from God. Otherwise, we'll end up blaming God for tempting us. And ever since Adam and Eve fell into sin, their fallen human nature has been prone to shift the blame for their own evil deeds. Remember when God confronted Adam in the garden? Do you know what he replied? Genesis 3 and verse 12. The woman you put here with me, she gave me some fruit from the tree and I ate it. And then God confronted Eve. Verse 13. What is this you have done? And the woman said, the serpent deceived me and I ate. You see, both of those statements are technically true, but they dodge the personal responsibility for sin. And Adam's answer really blamed God. The woman you gave me, that's your fault. Now James wants us to see that if we go down that route, we will not overcome temptation and we'll actually impugn the holy character of God. You know, there's a very powerful and insightful observation in Proverbs chapter 19. And verse 3, which says, a person's own folly leads to their ruin, yet their heart rages against the Lord. It's their own folly, and yet we blame God. And you know, the Bible has numerous instances of the shifting the blame for sin. You know, there was a rather humorous incident, if sin can ever be regarded as humorous, where Aaron made the golden calf. Exodus 32, and beginning in verse 2. Aaron answered the people, take off the gold earrings that your wives and your sons and your daughters are wearing, bring them to me. So all of the people took off of their earrings and brought them to Aaron, and he took what they handed him, and he made it into an idol, cast in the shape of a calf, and he fashioned it with a tool. And then they said, these are your gods who brought you out of Egypt. And so Aaron took the gold, he fashioned it with a tool, made it into the golden calf. But when Moses confronts him, how did Aaron reply? Well, it's in verse 24. He says, so I told them, whoever has gold jewelry, take it off. And then they gave me the gold, and do you know what, Moses? I threw it into the fire. And guess what happened? Out came this calf. It's amazing. It just happened. You see, when we're tested, it's easy to blame God for our own sin. But just because God tests us or allows us to be tested doesn't mean that he is responsible for our sin. I mean, take for example a maths teacher who sets a test. The purpose of the test is to show the student what they know. But if the student hasn't learned the material, the test doesn't cause the student's failure. It's the lack of study. It's the lack of revision. It's the lack of knowledge in the student. The test is the occasion for the failure, but it's not the cause of the failure. See, it's very important for us to see. The student could easily say, that stupid maths teacher hadn't have tested me, I wouldn't have failed. But you see, the poor mark in the test wasn't down to the teacher. It was down to the student. And so James nails this fallacious line of blame shifting. James 1 and verse 13. When tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. It's impossible for God to be tempted by evil because of his holy nature. And so James's argument is, since God cannot be tempted by evil, it follows that he himself does not tempt anyone. And if we want to overcome temptation, we must at the outset put out of our minds all shifting of blame, especially blaming God. So where does temptation come from? Well, verse 14. But each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desire and enticed. Now, James doesn't mention Satan here is a source of temptation. He's going to do that, actually, later in chapters 3 and 4. But he wants us to see that to blame God, or to blame our circumstances, or to blame the devil, or to blame anyone else for our sin, is to dodge the real source of it, and is to absolve ourselves from responsibility for it. You see, there is no hope for us overcoming unless we acknowledge that it comes from our own evil desires. But conversely, there is hope for victory when I begin to recognize and I begin to be on guard against what lies within me. Now, in this little passage, James uses a sexual metaphor to describe how sin has its way in our hearts. Here's what happens in verse 14. We are dragged away by our own evil desires and we are enticed. And that word enticed means that we are seduced. It's like that young man being seduced or enticed by the loose woman of Proverbs chapter 7. And then what comes next is clearly part of this sexual metaphor that James is developing. In verse 15, then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. See, after you've been seduced by your evil desires, then there's conception, and then there's birth. And believe it or not, there's even a grandchild. Because after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and when sin is full grown, it becomes a mother as well, and it gives birth to death. Now, what are we being told here? Well, the phrase evil desire in verse 14 is one that the translators have had difficulty with in translating. In the King James, if you had one of the old King James versions in front of you, it would be translated lust. The New Revised Standard Version just says one's own desire. Now, the Greek word that's being translated here is the word epithema. And it means literally an over desire. It's like an epicenter. It's the ultimate center. It's the intensity. It's a craving, a longing, a yearning, a desire. And James says that the essence of sin is an epithema, an over desire. The way sin works is not that we want bad things. That's what's kind of misleading about this translation. The way that sin works, the essence of sin, is not that we want bad things, but we want things so badly, that we want things too badly. We have an epi-desire, an over-desire. And this tells us that our over-desires are what seduces us. Now, this is really a powerful theological imagery that James is painting for us here. In the Old Testament, God tells us that he never sees sin as just breaking the rules. He always sees it as spiritual adultery. God characterizes himself as a husband and the Israelites as his wife. And he says the reason that people sin is that they are enticed away into the arms of other lovers. Now, what are these other lovers? And again, we might think, well, that's when Israel wanted to do bad things. But no, that's not the case. Anything that becomes a way to self-esteem more than God becomes to us a fatal attraction. See, that's what an epi-desire is. It's a fatal attraction. What the Bible tells us is sin is not just breaking the rules. Sin begins when something becomes your paramour, your secret illicit lover, rather than God. Something other than God becomes the authority for your self-esteem. For example, it's okay to want a career, to work on it, to progress. But when that career becomes the way that you feel good about yourself, and the way that you become happy about life, in fact, it becomes your life, then it's become a fatal attraction. Because you'll go after it, you need to have it, you have to have it. And nothing is going to get in your way. And you know, the Bible says that is spiritual adultery. That's how sin starts. And you say, well, what's wrong in having a career? Well, nothing. But an epi-desire for a career is seduction. And it will entice us, spiritually speaking. And you know, the same is true with romance. You know, when we say, look, I won't be anybody unless somebody loves me. I won't be able to live if Jack or Jill or Bill or Susie doesn't love me. It's not so much the person as it is romantic love itself that has become an idol. It's the romance that makes you feel like a human being. And an epi-desire for romance is a fatal attraction. And James says, look, sin starts that way. When we add something to Jesus Christ as a requirement for being happy, and something that you've just got to have, then he says you're being seduced and you're being enticed. If we say, look, Jesus is nice, God is nice, and of course I pray to God, I'm a Christian, but if I don't have this, and you can fill in the blank yourself, if I don't have this in my life, well, my life's over. Then we have an epi-desire that will entice us into sin. This is really what the Bible defines as lust. That's why some of the older translations use the word lust in verse 14. Lust is not wanting bad things, although it could be that. Lust is wanting things badly, so badly that you're fatally attracted to them. It's the attitude that I have to have it, and I'm going to have it, otherwise I'm not going to be happy. And God sees you sleeping with that. This has become your lover. And as a result, it's controlling you. And it's a fatal attraction. Now what happens when your every desires entice you and seduce you away? Well, conception, which leads to the birth of sin. And conception means something on the inside that eventually comes outside. So you might punch somebody in the mouth, and you might harm them. You might even kill them. But it starts with anger. That's the conception. It's something on the inside that is going to give birth later. And all sinful actions start as little embryos in the heart. All of our resentments, all of our anxieties come from these epi desires. Why do we get so bitter about certain things? It's because something we think we have to have has been taken away from us. That's why we get so angry about it. Why can we get so anxious? Why do we become so afraid? Why are we tempted to lie? It's because our epi desire is under threat. Take the person who has made their career everything in their life. And one day their boss comes to them and asks them to lie over a certain matter. Otherwise, you're going to be demoted or you're going to be fired. And so the person says, well look, I had to lie for the sake of my career. Now, when we look at that situation carefully, there was two possible reactions that the person could have had. You know, one person could have said, look, fine, fire me then. But I'm not going to lie. And the other person says, I know it was wrong, but I had to do it. You see, what's giving birth to that lie? It's not the boss. You see, what's the difference between the two reactions? Well, the person who lies is lying because they have a fatal attraction to their job, to their precious career. The lying comes from the fear of losing that position. The job itself. The fear which is conceived gives birth to the lie. But the little embryo of fear has come because of the fatal attraction to the career. So you see how this works. Sin is not just breaking the rules. Sin is a fatal attraction that conceives all of those troubling emotions that are deep in our hearts and that will then lead to sinful behavior. They have come because we were seduced by one of our lover gods. And then James says, after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. See, with an epic desire for success, you're going to kill your body with overwork. With an epic desire for love, if you don't get that person, you'll kill yourself with self-remorse and bitterness. Actually, even if you do get that person, you'll destroy the relationship because of all of the expectation that you're putting on that person to make your life absolutely perfect. See, this is how it works. Sin will lead to death. The death comes from the sin. The sin comes from the conception. The conception comes from being seduced. A fatal attraction to something which you love more than God. Now what are we going to do about that? How can we escape? How can we possibly ever get away from all of this? After all, James says, I don't want you to be deceived. Well, the answer is we have to work backwards. If you think of sin as simply breaking the rules, then you'll think, well, the only way that I can deal with temptation is to say no. Do you remember that slogan that was around a few years ago? Just say no. Well, saying no is certainly part of dealing with sin, but it's not the main part, and it's not the only part. You see, one of the ways that you could deal with temptation is the way that Ulysses did. He was going by the Cyrenes, and he was afraid of being tempted by them. So what did he do? Well, he tied himself to a mast in front of hundreds of people, and he says, no matter what I say, don't let me out. See, that's one way that we can deal with temptation. So a rather severe way, And frankly, to be honest, in a pinch, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, when it's severe, tie yourself to a mask and tell everybody, watch me like a hawk, don't let me do it. But you know, in the long run, people get bored with that. They'd rather go off and watch the film than watch the TV than saying, I've got to stay here and watch Ulysses tied to a mast. You see, there's a better way. Thomas Chalmers was a Scottish preacher in the 1840s, and one of his most famous sermons was entitled The Expulsive Power of a New Attraction. And the main point of his sermon was simply this. The only way to break the hold of a beautiful object on the soul is to show it an even more beautiful object. You see, you can't just say no when you find that sin is due to the fact that your imagination has been captivated by something. And so the answer to temptation is not just negation, it's not just discipline, it's not just saying no. The answer is a spiritual passion. Instead of being in love with all of these false lovers that entice us away, we have to fall in love with somebody else. That's the answer. We have to bring Jesus out of the realm of the conceptual. We have to bring him out of the realm of the theoretical. And we have to bring him into the realm of a loving relationship so that he is the passion of our hearts. And we have to look to this lover, Jesus. And we have to look at what he has done for us. I mean, do we see it clearly? Do we see what Jesus has done for us? What he has done for you? You know, Jesus was stripped naked so that you could be adorned in fine linen. He was so disfigured so that you could be beautiful. He was punished so that you could be forgiven. He was wounded that you could be healed. He was made sin with your sinfulness that you may be made righteous with his righteousness. He died your death so that you can receive life. He endured your poverty so that you might share in his abundance. He bore your shame so that you might share in his glory. He endured your rejection so that you might have acceptance with the Father. He was made a curse so that you could receive every spiritual blessing. Have any of these other lover gods done that for you? You see, of course not. Look what Jesus has done for you. Fall in love with him. That's the only way that you're going to deal with the downward spiral that James is talking about. The only way to break the hold of one beautiful object from the soul is to show it a more beautiful object. It is the expulsive power of a new affection. And our new affection must be Jesus. See, this is why Christianity is so way beyond just the way we behave. It doesn't just say no. Think back to how James tells the poor person to deal with their poverty and the rich person to deal with their riches. James 1 and verse 9. Believers in humble circumstances ought to take pride in their high position. And what is their high position? See, if you're a Christian, the Bible says, in Christ, you are seated at the right hand of God, and you should take pride in that high position that you have. Think about the beauty of it. See, this isn't behaviorism. You'll never overcome your temptations unless you're living in the holy consciousness of who you are in Christ Jesus. The only way a poor person is going to overcome bitterness, the only way those of you who haven't got the things in life that you want will overcome your bitterness too, is to fall in love with Jesus. You see, you're supposed to take pride, the Bible says. It's an astonishing statement, isn't it? To take pride. Clothe yourself in the self-esteem that Christ has given you. The only lover who can do this for you is Jesus. Verse 10, but the rich should take pride in their humiliation. What? Take pride in his low position? Yes. The way to humble yourself is to remind yourself you are a sinner saved by grace. In other words, the poor person deals with the temptation to despair by remembering the glory of grace and all that that has provided. But the rich person has to deal with the temptation to be arrogant by remembering the grace of glory. That the glory comes to us strictly by the grace of God and not by anything that we've done or that we've earned. Think about Jesus. Think about what he has done for you. Whatever your physical circumstances may be, take pride in him. Clothe yourself in him. The only way to break the grip of sin on your heart, the only way to break the grip of a beautiful object on your heart is to show it a more beautiful one. And that more beautiful one is Jesus. So look to him, focus on him, fix your eyes upon him, fall in love with him. Because just saying no will not break the stranglehold of sin. And James says in verse 16, please, 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 do not be deceived, my dear brothers and sisters. Say yes to Jesus. Take pride in who he is and what he has done for you, because he is the one who cuts off the power of sin in our lives, and he is the one who will move us towards the crown of life.